Welcome to the program for Wednesday, September 5th, 2012, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today in the 3 o'clock hour, it is Pentagon Solutions. Later on in this hour, I'll take you to the 5th Annual Warfighter Support IT Day, and you'll hear from James Kraft, the Chief Information Officer for the Joint Improvised Explosive Device Defeat Organization, JIDO, as he talks about his needs in running that organization, the technological shop at that organization. That's later on in this hour of Pentagon Solutions on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Pleased to start, though, with Michael O'Hanlon. He is Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. His two most recent books are Bending History, Barack Obama's Foreign Policy, and The Wounded Giant, America's Armed Forces in an Age of Austerity. Mike, it is great to have you back on the program. Thanks for being here today.
Just great to be with you. Thanks a lot for having me on.
You are just back from China. Talk about what you were in China doing and what you saw there as it relates, especially to the DOD's revised and updated strategy.
Yeah, well, like many American strategists and military scholars, I sort of got preoccupied with the wars in the broader Middle East in the last decade. And so taking a page out of our foreign policy, reconceptualization under President Obama, I've tried to rebalance a bit towards Northeast Asia, which I've been trying to do the last couple of years. And in particular, as you know, air-sea battle has become a big concept at the Department of Defense. It's primarily an Air Force and Navy concept. It's not associated with too many big new weapons platforms. It's mostly about ensuring access through better missile defense, better anti-submarine warfare, better communications in general, improved sustainability and survivability of communications links and satellites, a number of such matters, and also just making sure that these two services think coherently and cogently about the kind of challenges that they and the broader country are facing now in disputed waterways around the world. But, of course, China is going to be the most capable at threatening waterways or threatening access that we've been accustomed to in the past. And so air-sea battle winds up in many ways being seen as synonymous with dealing with the Western Pacific, although that's not really the exclusive focus. Anyway, that's the backdrop, and I'm sure many of your listeners know that already. But that was my interest, learning about that particular doctrine and more generally about the state of the U.S.-China strategic and military competitions. You know, just one more way to motivate the discussion, although I doubt many listeners need motivation since we're all aware of how rapidly China's rising. But one way to think about it is, you know, China's defense budget is now estimated in the range of $150 to $180 billion a year. And China's economy is doubling roughly every 8 to 10 years. And the defense budget is increasing more or less proportionately. And what that means is if you just extrapolate it out, recognizing that's not going to be a perfect predictor, but if you were to just do that as a mental exercise, by about 2020, China's pushing $300 billion a year in equivalent military spending. And you can have big debates about proper methodology. And so let's say it's between $250 billion and $300 billion, but it's in that range. Meanwhile, we will have been coming down for a decade. So this debate, which was sort of beginning in the 90s, is now really going to take center stage because our wars are no longer going to be artificially pumping up our defense budget. Our deficit concerns are going to be putting downward pressure on the budget. If sequestration happens, of course, that's even more downward pressure. And so next thing you know, by the end of the decade, we could be looking at a U.S. military funded at roughly $500 billion a year, a Chinese military with a much narrower geographic area of activity funded at closer to $300 billion. And these lines start to converge, especially if you break down the U.S. defense budget by theater and you try to compare apples to apples, you know, U.S. capabilities that are generally available for the Pacific vis-a-vis Chinese capabilities. My point is this is a daunting challenge. I don't know yet the right answer, but we defense planners have to fully engage on the nature of the rising China and what it means for all of our interests in the broader region. Doesn't have to be a bad relationship, but it obviously has the potential to go either good or bad, and I think it's important, therefore, to focus on.
Now, you wrote about air-sea battle, Mike, in the Washington Post recently, and one of the things that you wrote is the air-sea battle concept seeks to use new technologies to counter these perceived Chinese initiatives, the one that you spoke about and you write about.
about some of these, including some of the weapons systems that China is building, as well as similar, if more modest, efforts by Iran to challenge U.S. capabilities in the Persian Gulf. What's the takeaway that we should have when you talk about China and their more limited sphere of influence, or the area, a more limited area that they wish to have influence over? And the remark that you make there about Iran, I think, informs something that you said earlier, and that is that the United States will, we expect at least, will continue to have a much more broad area in which we would like to have influence.
Yeah, thank you. Well, first thing I should say is, as you know, my co-author on that op-ed was Jim Steinberg, who had been Deputy Secretary of State through the first half of 2011 in the Obama administration. And it was very important, I think, to hear his voice on this because, of course, he was a State Department official and was known as one of the Obama officials who was at the center of U.S.-China diplomacy and was looking for a way to manage the U.S.-China competition. And so for Jim and myself to come out and try to say, listen, there is some military logic to this concept, I think was a little bit notable because in the Pentagon these days and in China, air-sea battle is seen by some as an overly confrontational way to look at our military needs in the theater. And the point of the article that Jim and I wrote was basically, listen, there are a lot of dangers in this relationship, but air-sea battle is a natural military response to many of the modernizations that China's undertaking to threaten our access to the region through things like accurate munitions that would come off of ballistic missiles that could be fired at our aircraft carriers, or better Chinese submarines that could elude our anti-submarine warfare sensors and approach aircraft carriers and make it much harder and more dangerous for them to operate near Taiwan or Japan or other American interests in the vicinity. And so it is sort of a natural military dynamic that China would be trying to do some of what it's doing and that we would respond. In and of itself, this doesn't connote any kind of hostile intent from either country, but it has the potential to really go south if it's not managed properly within a broader relationship. And so I think that was really the central message, that air-sea battle is fine as far as it goes, but it should not be mistaken for a grand strategy or a China policy. And to the extent it became such, it could actually be dangerous. That was, if anything, the probably the main theme that we wanted to get across.
One thing that I took away from this and our conversations in the past is that you're cognizant of the relationship, obviously, between the United States and China and the potential that it has for the future, but you're also thinking about Asia and the Pacific in a more holistic sense. And what I wonder about when it comes to the way that we are thinking about that part of the world is whether there is a fear that some analysts may be too focused on China one-on-one and not thinking about the fact that Russia continues to want to have at least a fair amount of influence in that part of the world as well.
Well, it's a good question. Although Russia would not have been the first country I added to the list, you're right to add it as one of several. But I do think that the constellation of countries that's involved in the Western Pacific actually provides us a lot of inherent advantages and should be reassuring to Americans. What I mean by that is that to the extent China were to feel its oats and try to start translating its new economic power, you know, it's obviously the world's number two economic power. It's the world's number two military power, at least by spending. And in its own mind, it may also even be now poised to rival us as the number one East Asia power, even contending directly with the United States. To the extent that China were to think that way, or at least some Chinese hardliners, we have a natural way to react, which is, let's say, on some of these disputed uninhabitable islands that so many East Asian countries are having big disputes over this year and last. If China were to get even more aggressive in seizing some of those, in, you know, firing upon other countries' forces or fishermen who might be in proximity, we don't have to necessarily respond proportionately. What we can do is talk to these other countries. Not only Japan and Korea and Australia are strong treaty allies, but even the Philippines, you know, still an ally, but no longer as close as before, or even Vietnam. And we can basically make it clear to China that, listen, if you start getting assertive, This is going to increase the likelihood of a return of American military bases to some of these countries. For example, we're already putting four small warships in Singapore as an operational convenience, but we could go well beyond that in the Philippines, where we left 20 years ago with our Subic and Clark bases, or Vietnam, where, of course, we left almost 40 years ago. And these governments might very well want us back. And so we don't have to necessarily have our first response be a violent one, even if China itself gets violent. And I think that should be, frankly, reassuring. This overall portfolio of issues is not totally reassuring. It's an unsettling and dynamic situation. And when two big new heavyweights are contending in the international arena, as you know and as I know from history, that's always a tense and fraught proposition. But we do have a lot of options because of these other countries, many of which are watching China even more warily than we are and would want to send some kind of a message of response if they felt they were getting bullied by China.
The two words that you used, unsettling and dynamic, also apply to the situation that we're dealing with here at home that has to do with the defense budget. And now that we've had a chance to talk a little bit about some of the challenges, the major challenges that we have to look forward to over the next several years, when we come back from this break, I would like to talk to you, Mike, about what the dynamic may look like here at home, budget-wise, in the next couple of months / years. Michael O'Hanlon is Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. He's an author, an op-ed writer, and my conversation with him will continue in just a moment on Pentagon Solutions on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Making dollars and cents out of data center consolidation. A panel discussion with experts from government, sponsored by Brocade. Panelist Zach Baldwin, Cloud Computing Program Manager at GSA.
In the initiative of the 2 years, I think the biggest barrier is to really do data center consolidation, you have to successfully deliver enterprise services from a centralized location. Culturally, people don't like to give up control. They want to see the blinking lights. They think they can do it better and cheaper. Which they're not capturing the fully loaded cost of some of these rogue data centers.
Right.
But also, it's been institutionalized by the way the budget's done.
Meet the future head-on. Brocade's networking solutions provide government agencies with the high performance, reliability, and flexibility they need to securely deliver mission-critical services while maximizing taxpayer dollars. To hear the panel making dollars and cents out of data center consolidation in its entirety, go to federalnewsradio.com, search data center.
Federal News Radio 1500 AM, your source for federal news now.
Here's Mariela Malero, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, on the Accelerate and Streamline for Better Customer Service panel, sponsored by CA Technologies.
The foundational design work has to be done based on what the customer needs. ELIS, the electronic platform, is all about listening to the voice of the customer, from how to set up an account to how to manage that account. It's not us managing the account. It's the customer managing the account, and we managing then the interaction that comes out of that account.
To listen to the whole program made possible by CA Technologies, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
At CA Technologies, we enable agencies to focus on service delivery, not just infrastructure, and on supporting strategic goals, not just fixing what's broken. We accelerate IT so agencies can drive innovation with the cloud and other new technologies. We transform IT to simplify complexity and free up resources. We secure IT to keep sensitive assets safe.
Find out how CA Technologies can help your agency accelerate, transform, and secure IT at ca.com/public sector.
Universal Consulting Services, proudly supporting our nation's warfighters and their families by providing pioneering solutions in acquisition management, enterprise IT, health services, and strategic program support to the Department of Defense and federal civilian agencies and installations worldwide. Universal Consulting Services, meeting today's missions with tomorrow in mind. To learn more about how they can help your agency achieve its mission, visit them at universal-inc.net.
I'm Beyonce with an important message about hunger in America. Did you know 1 in 8 people struggle with hunger? Over 12 million children live in homes where there isn't always enough food. Food banks are experiencing more demand than ever. Show Your Helping Hand is a nationwide campaign with the goal of helping Feeding America deliver millions of meals to local food banks. Please join me in showing a helping hand to fight hunger. More information is available at showyourhelpinghand.com.
I'm Emily Kopp. On Thursday's Federal Drive, we're live from the Excellence in Government Conference in downtown Washington. Deputy Chief Management Officer Beth McGrath tells us how the Defense Department is getting creative. And typography expert Simon Garfield tells us which federal websites pass muster. It all starts at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for the latest federal news, check out federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, Pentagon Solutions Today, with my guest Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. And I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, Mike, that one of your most recent books is titled The Wounded Giant, America's Armed Forces in an Age of Austerity. And that is really a very accurate way of saying where we are, I think, fiscally. Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen when it comes to sequestration. We don't know exactly what contractors will be dealing with, the landscape, but we're already starting to see a few little signs here and there. How are you reading the tea leaves that we've gotten so far, few as they may be?
Well, it's interesting to try to think this process through. And, of course, the politics of the election matter a lot in terms of what might be done in a lame duck session or early in January. And there are so many permutations that it makes my head hurt to think about them. But let's just say sequestration does kick in, that there's no immediate alternative that's passed by the Congress and signed by the president. And so as of January, we start to see these cuts. And Todd Harrison from another think tank, CSBA, has done some nice work on this recently, so I would recommend that to people. What you would probably see is roughly a $55 billion plus or minus cut in available resources for the 2013 fiscal year that remains at that point. That's in budget authority, as I understand the way sequestration would work. And that could apply – that number is calculated relative to just sort of the core – peacetime defense budget, but it could apply to all Pentagon accounts. Now, the White House has said it would exempt, as it's allowed, military personnel, so nobody in uniform has to worry about their pay or their immediate compensation packages. But it probably would be applied to other parts of the Pentagon budget, quite likely including war costs as well. Now, I'm not totally convinced that war costs can be streamlined the same way. And even if they were, you might have to redirect funds from that core budget to compensate, because I'm not sure there's enough give there. In any event, what you're looking at is something like 8 to 10% reductions in the budget authority for 2013 overall, let's say 8%. But because 2013 will already be 25% over by then, the amount of funds will be the amount of savings will have to be generated in a shorter period, 9 months, which means that you're talking about effective cuts that could approach 12 to 15% for the remainder of the fiscal year in certain areas, such as civilian employees and their salaries. And so something that's obviously very much up the alley of this radio station and its listeners is the issue of DOD civilian employees. And there's a distinct possibility, as I read the situation, that assuming DOD won't want to fire people outright, that you could have up to a couple months of average furlough time in the remainder of fiscal year 2013. Now, my guess is sequestration is not going to last all of 2013. And so I don't want to get people too anxious. And there are, I'm sure, folks at OMB and elsewhere who could spell out the likely implications of sequestration in more technical and accurate detail than I can. But this is my general understanding of where we are, that if this process were to begin to unfold, because civilian salaries, outlays and budget authority sort of go out at a roughly comparable rate, you would in fact start to see a need for very severe cuts in civilian pay right away, and it could be handled by this notion of a furlough. That's obviously not ideal. Some jobs are going to be seen as too important that, you know, they couldn't be subject to furlough. Obviously, we'd like to think all civilian jobs at DOD are important, but not all are equally time urgent. Maybe that's the better way to put it. And so you wind up looking at furloughs that could even be longer than 2 months for people whose jobs are not seen as quite as time urgent. Whereas for the defense contractor world, if Todd Harrison's analysis is correct, you would have Sure, that 10 or 12 or 15% reduction in available budget authority for the rest of fiscal 2013, but you would also have funds from previous years that were still being outlaid, and you would have other sources of funds that were unobligated from previous years. And so the actual payments to contractors, and therefore their employees, might only go down by 5 or 6% for that remaining part of 2013. So that's obviously not ideal from the point of view of a contractor who also might be suffering a loss in revenue because our war budgets are declining so fast right now. But nonetheless, it's much less stark and dramatic than what would happen to those civilian DOD salaries. That's the beginning of how to understand sequestration's possible effects. Of course, the broad point here is this is not a good way to do strategy. Here we are just managing, you know, crises, worrying about which of our friends in the D.C. area and around the country are going to have to deal with short-term sort of artificial financial, urgencies created by a federal law that doesn't have a lot of logic behind it, that has nothing to do with adopting a more sound American defense policy, that I think disrespects the commitment and service of those federal employees, whether civilian or military, but in this case, particularly civilian. And so I just, like many people, am abhorred by the prospect of sequestration. There may be an argument for making another round of defense budget reductions, but the way in which sequestration would do it, the abruptness, the depth, the severity of those cuts, I think is really regrettable.
Is that where you think, Mike, the hope lies for something to happen between now and January 2nd, the idea that many people who are experts like yourself are saying, yes, there may be some place for reductions in the budget, but this is the wrong way to go about doing it. Let's try it strategically.
Well, it's possible, although the hard part of that is to generate the kind of overall deficit reductions that were mandated by the Budget Control Act of 2011. You've got to do something pretty big. And it's not as if you can just, sell a couple of federal parks that no one's heard of to some investor for a couple billion bucks and paper it over that way. I don't mean to be too frivolous, but you see my point.
Yes.
There are always ways to find a billion here, a billion there in the old Senator Dirksen, metaphor or image. But when you're talking about trying to generate $1.2 trillion in 10-year savings in the federal budget, it's not that easy. And we will see if there's really a clear mandate for either political party to do it the way that political party would prefer come November 7th. I am skeptical. I think historically we wind up quite often with divided government, and that's the most likely outcome here. And on top of that, even if we don't have divided government, if either side has at least 40 votes in the Senate, they can really slow things down a great deal on thinking through major reforms in entitlements or taxes or other discretionary accounts besides defense or the Department of Defense itself. So I don't expect any, kumbaya moment of consensus on how to replace the sequestration cuts with something else. So I'm a little worried. I'm worried this could take a while and that we could get a few months into calendar year 2013 before we've really, staved off any worsening of a sequestration process. In theory, it could take even longer than that. But I would hope that certainly within the first 100 days of the next presidential and congressional terms, we'd get something better than what we've got in store right now.
Michael O'Hanlon's a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. His most recent books are Bending History, Barack Obama's Foreign Policy, and The Wounded Giant, America's Armed Forces in an Age of Austerity. One of the wild cards potentially in that political scenario is what is happening in the Middle East, in particular Iran. And we'll talk about that when I come back with Michael O'Hanlon in just a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Cloud First Report, presented by the cloud computing experts at GTSI and HP.
The Army and the Defense Information Systems Agency have reached a major milestone in their transition to a cloud-based email system. The Army now has 500,000 users on the system. Thousands of other users from the military's Joint Staff and U.S. European Command have migrated into the DISA private cloud as well. Officials say the work they've done so far will set the stage for other enterprise services like SharePoint, centrally managed secure mobile devices, and records management capabilities.
Public, private, hybrid. The options for moving to the cloud are many, and mandated transition deadlines are right around the corner. Industry leaders GTSI and HP have established a cloud center of excellence in Herndon, Virginia, specifically focused on navigating the cloud options available to agencies and to help you decide on what approach is best for your requirements. Get your head in the cloud. Contact a GTSI HP cloud computing expert and reap the benefits of increased operational efficiency and decreased program costs. Email hpccoe@gtsi.com today.
I'm Linda Carr, President and CEO of Advanced Alliance Solutions Team, AAST, a joint venture of small businesses dedicated to providing the federal government with exceptional services under the GSA Alliance Small Business Contract. Our goal is to team with small, medium, and large IT companies to deliver needed services to the federal government.
Please contact them at advancedalliant.com for potential small business teaming opportunities. That's advancedalliant.com.
Hey, Jamie, who sings that song? Whoa, piece of bread.
That can't possibly be a real song.
No, it is. We heard it on the car radio this morning.
Matt, we really need to get HD radio so you can hear song lyrics better. Actually, we should get a Kia Sorento with the Yuvo infotainment system and HD radio. This way you can hear all your corny lyrics with crystal clear digital sound quality, and I can listen to good music on the extra FM HD2 and HD3 stations it offers. Now sing that song again to me.
Whoa.
Voice-activated Yuvo infotainment system with HD radio. Now available in the Kia Sorento.
You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Pentagon Solutions today with Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. And, Mike, we talked about the political implications of sequestration just a moment ago. And one of the elements, one of the wild cards potentially in that decision-making process could be what happens, if anything, in the Middle East. The status quo right now is that people generally believe that Iran is building at least one nuclear weapon. The indication is that they are continuing apace and are not don't seem to feel threatened by any of the countries that have tried to prevent them from developing that weapon. Is there a potential there for something to really change the way that all of us look at sequestration, the budget situation with the Pentagon, the strategy that they have recently come out with and so forth?
You know, I think in broader political terms, yes. If there were a military conflict against Iran, even if it stayed relatively contained and involved a couple days of airstrikes with the United States participating, followed by an extended period of some Iranian retaliation of some kind or another, largely through terrorism, but a heightened state of defenses for us and for our allies in the Persian Gulf region. Even if that came to play, you could use the contingency fund in the federal budget to deal with the excess costs from higher operational tempo and replenishment of munitions and things like that. But it would change the politics, clearly, the politics of the country. We would be in our third war, in a way that Libya obviously wasn't. I mean, Libya was a limited military operation which had at least a partially decisive effect, but it was the exception that proves the rule. Iran would be much more akin to, I think, the kind of wars we've been involved in the broader Middle East vis-a-vis Iraq. At least it would make us in a position like we were in Iraq in the 90s, with that long period of no-fly zones, heightened vigilance, occasional bombing raids. In other words, the country, I think, would feel a different sense about our greatest concerns and threats, and there'd be worries about Iranian terrorist retaliation, even against the American homeland. Even if Iran didn't do that, there'd be a lot of people worried that it might. So we'd go through a whole period that felt a little bit like the aftermath of 9/11 again for at least a few months. I think the whole national political atmosphere, therefore, would change, and that might affect the likelihood of changing the sequestration scenario or trajectory that we're on more quickly or averting it altogether. That's just a general sense. I don't want to make any specific predictions because I would just make myself look silly. There are too many things at play here to know at what point the Congress and the president would rally together. But the bottom line is you don't really, you could wage war against Iran in this limited fashion and still carry out sequestration-like cuts at the same time as long as you had a contingency fund to handle the immediate costs of the conflict. I don't recommend that. But in principle, you know, budgetarily, it's possible. And therefore, you've got the technical side saying there's no requirement to immediately change sequestration just because of this conflict. But the political atmosphere is going to be much different and might lead to a change more rapidly than otherwise.
Mike, I always appreciate your insights. Thank you very much for spending so much time with me today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Francis.